Welcome to the Unheard Daily Podcast. The article you're about to listen to is narrated by the team over at NOAA and is taken from today's Unheard edition. You can read other great articles as well as listen to and watch more Unheard content over at unheard.com or via the Unheard app.
For NOAA, this is Sam Scholl reading from Unheard, where on the 12th of November, 2022, Paul Kingsnorth writes, "Who are the eco-fascists?" You might have heard about the rising threat of eco-fascism. If you haven't, you soon will. Because the number of people warning about this new danger to civilization seems to be growing exponentially. In publications right and left and neither, you'll be able to read along expositions of the origins and intentions of this frightening movement, which seems to be taking root all over the world. Those essays and articles could be rolled into one easily enough. The formula is always the same and can be usefully applied across the political spectrum. Start with talk of the rising tide of authoritarianism all over the world, as evidenced by populism, Brexit, Giorgia Meloni, Viktor Orban, Justin Trudeau, Donald Trump, Joe Biden, or any other leader you don't like. Move on to explore how much of this rising authoritarianism is reflected in environmentalism, as evidenced by Just Stop Oil, Extinction Rebellion, the Green New Deal, the Great Reset, Bill Gates, Greta Thunberg, or insert name of Bête Noire here. After this, list the historical inspirations for these new green authoritarians. Ted Kaczynski, Pentti Linkola, and Dave Foreman should do for starters. Dig into the most miserable chans and Reddits of the internet and expose a few anonymized avatars promoting race war in the name of the planet. Mention the Christchurch shooter. Use the phrase dark undercurrent a lot. Check in the names of a couple of nature writers from the 30s who became fascists. Mutter darkly about how Hitler was a vegetarian. Did you know there was an organic garden at Dachau? It makes you think. Having got here, you can move on to the meat of the thing, somberly intoning about the new threat to democracy represented by this movement. Depending on where you're coming from, you can now explain how these new eco-authoritarians represent either a threat to our God-given right to drive, mine, manufacture, fly, burn oil, and freely enjoy the glories that only Western progress can provide, or a threat to diversity, equality, human rights, LGBTQIA++ people, refugees, global justice, and a woman's right to choose. Either way, the conclusion will be much the same. A non-specific but ominous call for more monitoring of problematic views, more work to tackle radicalization, more laws to prevent protests and hate speech, and probably more internet regulation. For the safety of us all, of course. The problem, though, is that actual eco-fascism is notable mostly for its absence. Dark corners of the internet aside, you can find any craziness there, after all. It's hard to find a single eco-fascist anywhere out in the real world. No public intellectuals, no writers, no philosophers, no politicians, no popular movements embrace anything of any kind. Plenty of people get the label applied to them, of course. Without the prefix, the word fascist has been a meaningless, all-purpose insult for decades. But they all reject it. I was in and around the green movement for a long time, but I never met an eco-fascist, though I did have the pleasure of being called one. So, why all the dire warnings? There is something we can't bear to look at, and we are trying to distract attention from it by screaming at the people who are pointing it out. The thing we are avoiding is the thing that we used to call nature, and the reality that we are trying to distract attention from is that we are part of it. We live inside it, and that everything we do to it, we also do to ourselves. Change the climate out there, and it changes in here. Erode the soil, erode your soil. Poison the oceans, poison your culture. This is how it works, and this is what we are now facing. And we cannot face it, even those of us who think we can. Whatever we think our politics are, we have no idea what to do about the coming end of this brief age of abundance and the reappearance, armed and dangerous, of what we could get away with denying for a few decades, limits. Those who point these limits out, and who point out, especially, that the very existence of industrial modernity might be the root cause of the problems we currently face, can expect to be smacked down with the worst insults our culture can conjure. This is one explanation for the mysterious rise of the ghostly eco-fascists. But I think there might be another. The phrase eco-fascist is a label which is increasingly being applied to the wrong kind of environmentalist. Those who offer up a vision of humanity and nature that involves roots, traditions, smallness, simplicity, a return to previous life ways. They are contrasted with the right kind of green, those who are modern, global, progressive, and most importantly, friendly to the onward march of the technological society. Nearly a decade ago, I wrote an essay called Dark Ecology, about the state of environmentalism. In it, I wrote about the emergence of a tendency in green circles, which I called neo-environmentalism. The neo-greens, who preferred to call themselves eco-modernists, emerged as a reaction to the traditional green movement, which in its infancy had been relatively conservative, low-tech, and focused on the human scale. The neo-greens rejected all this as backward, impractical, and even dangerous. As I wrote back then, they believed that civilization, nature, and people can be saved only by enthusiastically embracing biotechnology, synthetic biology, nuclear power, geoengineering. The new environmentalism, they declared, in manifestos like this one, would be, as we might now say, grown up. Sucks to be right, as the kids say. Since I wrote that essay, the neo-greens have mounted an effective corporate takeover of most of the environmental movement. Examples of what we might call machine environmentalism have been embraced by the corporate sector, big NGOs, global institutions, and most of the intellectual class, most obviously in the Green New Deals that are popping up like summer daisies in all corners of the globe. Meanwhile, the green movement is splintering into camps determined by attitudes to the kind of intrusive and novel technologies that the machine greens are pushing. In Britain, this divide has been illustrated recently by attitudes to green pundit George Monbiot's latest book, which embraces the neo-green vision. In the humbly titled Regenesis, Monbiot, an urban vegan intellectual, makes a case, based naturally on the peer-reviewed science, for the end of most farming, and the replacement of much of its output with vat-grown bacterial food manufactured via industrial biotechnology. The vast acreages of land which have been stripped of their farmers can then be rewilded in various Monbiot-approved ways, which mainly seem to involve growing forests for always-on urbanites to go wolf-spotting at weekends. In promoting a high-tech, globalized food system, perhaps overseen by the world government he has previously argued for, and casually calling for the destruction of the basis of post-Neolithic human civilization, Monbiot offers a perfect example of what a neo-green future will look like. Utopian, hyper-urban, technological, rational, and most of all, efficient. What matters now, as he explains, is mathematics. It's time we became obsessed by numbers. We need to compare yields, compare land uses, compare the diversity and abundance of wildlife, compare emissions, erosion, pollution, costs, inputs, nutrition. Welcome to what the greens have become. A number of actual farmers, who are also first-rate thinkers, have taken aim at Monbiot's machine-green dystopia in recent months. Simon Fairlie, Chris Smage, and John Lewis Stemple offer some of the best critiques. But while they might win the battle, they are, for now at least, losing the war. In October 2022, a pioneering Finnish solar food company, championed by Monbiot, was given EU permission to roll out production of their new sustainable protein as part of the European Green Deal. The company says that the laboratory in which it produces this novel food, which it calls Factory 01, is part of a food revolution that will, for the first time in history, detach food production from the land, the farmers who work it, and the culture it creates. Excitable admirers are already explaining that this may give us the ability to one day 3D print our own food. I'm salivating already. Older, crustier greenies like me, laboring under the yoke of a pre-modern sensibility, which makes us reluctant to eat the sludge and live in the pod, might feel that something has gone terribly wrong with the numbers-obsessed rationalism that underlies this new corporate-friendly green technology. But we have no 5-point plan of our own, And we can't peer review our intuition, so our complaints don't convince anybody who matters. And now the localists, the deep ecologists, the peasants, the small farmers, and anyone else whose human-scale vision might interfere with the march of progress, have been conveniently designated eco-fascists. The Green Movement, long ago co-opted by the left, has now been co-opted, too, by technocrats. For this reason, the neo-green, or should we say Soylent Green, food future, can't be viewed in isolation. It is only one aspect of the unfolding phenomenon, which has been dubbed the Fourth Industrial Revolution, a revolution in which the machine greens, wittingly or otherwise, are playing a key part. Dreamt up, like so many other catchy corporate catchphrases, by the World Economic Forum in 2015, the Fourth Revolution is a way of describing our historical moment. That same year, Foreign Affairs produced a book by the same name to accompany the annual Davos gathering of politicians, business leaders, and Bono. In it, the escapable Klaus Schwab explains in prose that could make a Martian invasion sound boring, "The first industrial revolution used water and steam power to mechanize production. The second used electric power to create mass production. The third used electronics and information technology to automate production. Now a fourth industrial revolution is building on the third. It is characterized by a fusion of technologies that is blurring the lines between the physical, digital, and biological spheres." The rest of the book, made up of offerings from various scientists, engineers, politicians, and philosophers, explores the implications of this blurring of lines between created and uncreated, natural and artificial, wild and tamed. Now that we inhabit what the neo-greens like to call the Anthropocene, now that we are, in H.G. Wells's formulation, men like gods, what do we intend to conjure with the thunder and the lightning that pours forth from our just and rational fingers? All of the contributors stress that overcoming the old-school distinction between the digital and the natural is the essence of the thing. Neil Gershenfeld, for example, defines the digital fabrication revolution, the one which will soon be growing our tank-bred bio-sludge dinners, as the ability to turn data into things and things into data. Intelligent buildings, wearable sensors, implanted chips. 6 years ago, when this book was written, these may have seemed radical. Today it feels as if they have been almost normalized. Partly this is because of the ubiquity of Amazon Alexas, smartphone apps, and endless boosterish narratives about the exciting future that AI is building. And partly it is because the COVID pandemic, as I wrote back in December, was used as a trial run for precisely the kind of technologies, smartphone-enabled passports, digital population tracking, media-driven narrative control, which are now increasingly sold to us as a means of saving the planet. It is no coincidence that some of the loudest proponents of machine environmentalism were also fanatical supporters of the COVID biosecurity state. We are being trained to like what is coming, or at least to shrug our shoulders and accept its inevitability. Perhaps the most important aspect of the Fourth Revolution, though, is what has been called the datafication. The book's chapter on big data explains that the knowledge available to each of us today on the internet dwarfs that which would have been available in the Great Library of Alexandria, the greatest repository of learning in the ancient world. But size, as they explain, isn't everything. Big data is also characterized by the ability to render into data many aspects of the world that have never been quantified before. Call it datafication. For example, location has been datafied, first with the invention of longitude and latitude, and more recently with GPS satellite systems. Words are treated as data when computers mine centuries worth of books. Even friendships and likes are datafied via Facebook. Here we see the same obsession with numbers that Georges Monbiot demands of us as we contemplate how to produce our food and live in our landscape. And it reveals the elision between machine environmentalism and the elite-driven tech revolution it is part of. What we can see is that both achieve their goals through the process of datafication, the quantification of everything. The pattern of reality will be transformed into bits and bytes, comparisons and yields, numbers and statistics, until even novels and friendships and meadows and family meals on winter nights can be measured and compared and judged for their relative contributions to efficiency and sustainability. There is a rift here, and we should gaze deep into it, because there is something down there that we need to make out. It is the ancient rift between those who embrace the mindset of datafication, which is in the form of sums and written language, one of the foundations of civilization, and those who are repelled by it. I suspect it can never really be healed because it marks the border between two distinct ways of seeing. I have referred to them as the ratio and the nous, but we could just as well call them left and right brain, mythos and logos, or perhaps most simply, the sacred and the profane. The fourth revolution and the machine environmentalism which it contains offer us a profoundly profane vision of the world. Life in this understanding is not a sacred thing, but an engineering challenge. It is something which can be studied, quantified, and constantly tweaked until we arrive at the most efficient version. This may be done with the best of intentions, or it may not. But the things which cannot be measured will, of course, be left out of the equation, and the things which cannot be measured happen to be the stuff of life, love, God, place, culture. The profound mystery of beauty, a sense of being rooted, a feeling for land or community or cultural traditions, or the unfolding of human history over generations, song, art. They'll datafy all of this soon enough, no doubt, or try to. But the kind of people who think that the Great Library of Alexandria contained exabytes worth of information rather than the collected fruits of hard-won wisdom are lost before they ever sit down to their datasets. If you have ever wondered why climate change has so utterly dominated the green debate to the exclusion of so many other problems which stem from industrial society, mass extinction, soil erosion, the collapse of human cultures, ocean pollution, then the answer, I think, is here. Climate change is a problem amenable to numerical questions and technocratic answers. It is, furthermore, a problem which, almost by definition, can only be solved by elites. If you can't read or understand the peer-reviewed science, then you are open to being intimidated into fearful silence by those who can, or claim they can. And those people, drawn as all green thought leaders are, from the upper strata of society, will bring with them a worldview which treats the mass of humanity like so many cattle to be herded into the sustainable zero-carbon pen. If you're wondering where you've heard this story before, just dig out your dirty old COVID mask. It will all come flooding back. Interestingly, some of the progenitors of the Fourth Revolution are themselves uneasy about where some of it is leading. Even Klaus Schwab, who these days is often lazily presented as a volcano-dwelling Bond villain pulling the global strings, admits to unease at the speed and scale of change. He has voiced concern about how our quintessential human capacities, such as compassion and cooperation, might be eroded by deep shifts like these. It is already changing our health and leading to a quantified self, and sooner than we think, it may lead to human augmentation. Even as he promotes it, Schwab can see what is coming. Google Maps and smartphone apps were always just the beginning. We are headed into a brave new world of all-knowing smart homes and fat-grown sludge for breakfast, and every step along that road will make perfect rational sense. A panopticon world, remade at the nano level by the allegedly well-meaning, lies just around the corner. C.S. Lewis understood the trap well. Of all tyrannies, a tyranny sincerely exercised for the good of its victims may be the most oppressive. Those who torment us for our own goodwill torment us without end, for they do so with the approval of their own conscience. What the fourth revolutionaries never seem to grasp is that the question you ask will frame the philosophy you develop. If your question is, how can we remove all this atmospheric carbon and avoid what these computer models say is coming, then the answer can only lead you to a globalized technocracy. If, on the other hand, the question you ask is, how can we build lives which offer us meaning and alliance with the rest of nature? Then you may be led in a very different direction. It is the first kind of question that a machine society will always ask, and there will always be endless multiplying justifications for asking it. Ecology, equality, feminism, democracy, public health, growth, security, the war on terror or crime or drugs or whatever. There is always a reason for big data. The control is always necessary to prevent a greater evil. Even a movement which once challenged this grim way of seeing has today been bought and sold by it. For at least 200 years, we have been thoroughly undermining the foundations of all of our assumptions. Now, new cracks in the masonry are appearing daily. Can we caulk them up with vat-grown eco-sludge and hope they don't spread? Can big data come to our rescue? What can we measure, manage, monitor to help us escape from this? This is what I think, though I often wish I didn't. We are living now through what may be the final triumph of rational man. The tower he has made has nearly touched the very roof of the world. Every old story can tell us what will happen next. You are listening to Unheard, where Paul Kingsworth writes, "Who are the eco-fascists?" This article was published on the 12th of November, 2022, and was read by Sam Scholl for NOAA.